war right now. It's not a war against Iraq, nor is it a war against terrorism. It's a new war for our independence. At stake is our Constitution and the very freedoms we enjoy every day. You see, power-hungry politicians are quietly advancing something deceptively named the Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA. Proponents claim they are merely promoting trade by turning North and South America into a huge economic union. But in reality, it's a brazen scheme to eliminate the authority of the U.S. government, submitting our nation to the whims of a new regional superpower. America as we value it will steadily disappear, as will our rights, our Constitution, and our freedoms. Help win the war against the FTAA. Go to stoptheftaa.org and help keep America free. That's stoptheftaa.org.
Years ahead of the dominant media, find out first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com, on satellite, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
The sandy-haired son of Hollywood lost his faith in all that's good. Closed the curtain, unplugged the clock, hung his clothes on the shower rod, but he never got undressed, and no, he never made a mess. It's funny how life turns out, the odds of fate, the face of doubt. Camera one closes in, the soundtrack starts.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks here with you for the next hour on this June 17, 2005 edition of the broadcast. It's Friday, and there's a lot going on, and I want to kill the music and get right to it because, folks, we have a limited amount of time. First of all, I want to cover the Terry Schiavo autopsy. That news came out this week that the autopsy was released to the public, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I do want to make a couple of points. First of all, of course, the autopsy seems to vindicate Michael Schiavo. And ladies and gentlemen, this is very predictable. This is very predictable. As soon as Michael Schiavo came out and said that he favored an autopsy, I figured he more than likely had a way of fixing it. And I'm not sure how this was done. I can't prove it. But folks, Terry was examined by Dr. Hammesfahr, who is a world-renowned neurologist. And this is a point, we've made it in the past, but to counter the lies of the controlled media, we need to make it one more time. He examined her and said she had a good possibility of recovery if she was allowed the therapy that she required, that she needed, that any normal, ordinary person who didn't have a worm, for like Michael Schiavo, as a guardian, would have offered the loved one. And yet he's denied her therapy for all those years before she was finally dehydrated to death. So this guy has credentials after his name, and his notes, all his testimony, all everything that he said is right there documented on sweetliberty.org. Terry.sweetliberty.org. If anybody wants to know the truth, to counter the mainstream media lies, the controlled media's lies, it's all there. Terry.sweetliberty.org. Also, we have testimony or documentation, an article actually from WorldNet Daily, from a Florida neurologist, a separate neurologist, who said that Terry's no vegetable. He is a doctor for the state's Adult Protective Services. And he found that Terry had been wrongfully diagnosed, that she was not in a persistent vegetative state. And that's something that the media continued to throw around, and they're saying right now that she's so brain damaged, or was so brain damaged, that she couldn't have recovered. Folks, the lies continue to go forward about this case. They wanted her dead for some reason. Why was it that Michael Scheibel wouldn't release the body to the family after she was already dead? Was he afraid that they were going to take her and have her independently analyzed? And he was insisting prior to her death that her body be cremated, which would effectively destroy any evidence. What's the guy trying to hide? That's the question you have to ask. The transcript of the bone scan results, which was taken 53 weeks after Terry collapsed, revealed that she had fractured ribs, damage to her pelvic area, LI vertebrae, spine, both knees, both ankles, a broken femur, and a broken back. One doctor commented that somebody really worked this girl over. And yet, the autopsy says she has there's no sign of abuse. Go figure. So there's a lot of interesting things going on behind the scenes, you better guarantee. And I'm not so sure that money hasn't changed hands with this medical examiner. I have no proof of that. But, ladies and gentlemen, this thing has reeked from the very beginning, and it reeks to the very end. And that's all I'm going to say about that, because we've covered a lot of it in the past. I don't want to bore anybody, but it's just garbage. And Michael Scheibel. Yeah, we just really loved Terry. We loved her so much we had to kill her. As a matter of fact, his George Felix, his attorney. Yeah, this little maggot. After Terry passed away, this is what he had to say.
This death was not for the siblings and not for the spouse and not for the parents. This was for Terry. She has a right. She has a right to die peaceably.
Yeah, as if being dehydrated and starved to death is a peaceful death. What a piece of work this guy is. What a fiend. But at any rate, I just can't imagine how anybody can think that way. It's just amazing how obsessed with death these people are. Anyway, continuing on, this has been a very busy week. California has had 3 earthquakes this week so far, ladies and gentlemen. Are these earthquakes natural? That's the question you have to ask, as we've had the December 26, 2004 tsunami that took place, and we're going to be covering some information about that tonight as well, because Bill Clinton was on television Thursday night, last night, talking about, he was on the David Letterman show, and so we have some audio from him that we're going to be sharing tonight, because I think it's pretty revealing. But the earthquake in California, as you've probably heard, there were three of them, but one of them was off the coast. I think it was like 60 miles off the coast of California, and that triggered a tsunami alert. And now, it just seems kind of interesting that we had this massive Asian tsunami on December 26th, and now all of a sudden the world has awakened to the threat of a tsunami. It's almost like September 11th, 2001. Where we awoke to the so-called threat of terrorism, and now we've got terrorism everywhere? Well, we had an awakening on December 26th, the world did, about what a threat a tsunami could be. And then we started hearing about how the United States was going to get East Coast tsunami monitors, and now suddenly we have an earthquake off the coast of California, which brings with it the threat of a tsunami. Isn't this an amazing coincidence, or is it not a coincidence at all? As we've documented as well on this broadcast in the past, that, well, they were experimenting with a tsunami bomb. And that information you can also get if you go to AmericanExpose.com and click on the weather modification section, or you can go to weather.sweetliberty.org. And get to the same place. In that section, we have the tsunami bomb, New Zealand's devastating war secret. This was an article that was carried in 3 separate newspapers, And I know I've said this in the past, but folks, we've had new listeners coming on board all the time, and I want to make sure that the new listeners are just as up to speed as others are. Tsunami Bomb, NZ's Devastating War Secret. This is an article that appeared in the New Zealand Herald on June 30th of 2000. It was also carried in the Taipei Times and the Independent out of Britain. And it says, top secret wartime experiments were conducted off the coast of Auckland to perfect a tidal wave bomb declassified files reveal. An Auckland University professor seconded to the army set off a series of underwater explosions triggering mini tidal waves at Wangaparoa in 1944 and 1945, Professor Thomas Leach's work was considered so significant that United States defense chiefs said that if the project had been completed before the end of the war, it could have played a role as effective as that of the atomic bomb. Details of the tsunami bomb, known as Project Seal, are contained in a 53-year-old document. 53-year-old documents released by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Papers stamped top secret show the U.S. and British military were eager for the SEAL to be developed in the post-war years, too. They even considered sending Professor Leach to Bikini Atoll to view the U.S. nuclear tests and see if they had any application to his work. He did not make the visit. Although a member of the U.S. Board of Assessors of Atomic Tests, Dr. Carl Compton, was sent to New Zealand. Quote, Dr. Compton is impressed with Professor Leach's deductions on the SEAL project and is prepared to recommend to the Joint Chiefs of Staff that all the technical data from the test relevant to the SEAL project should be made available to the New Zealand government for further study by Professor Leach, unquote, said a July 1946 letter from Washington to Wellington. Professor Leach, who died in his native Australia in 1973, was the university's dean of engineering from 1940 to 1950. News of his being awarded a CBE in 1947 for research on a weapon led to speculation in newspapers around the world about what was being developed. Though high-ranking New Zealand and U.S. officers spoke out in support of the research, no details of it were released because the work was ongoing. A former colleague of Professor Leach, Neil Curtin, told the Weekend Herald that the experiments involved laying a pattern of explosives underwater to create a tsunami. Small-scale explosions were created out in the Pacific and off Wangaparoa, which at the time was controlled by the Army. It is unclear what happened to Project SEAL once the final report was forwarded to Wellington Defense Headquarters late in the 1940s. The bomb was never tested on a full scale, and Dr. Curtin doubts that Aucklanders would have noticed the trials. Whether it could be resurrected, he said, under some circumstances, I think it could be devastating. Unquote. And there you have it. So we know that they were working on the tsunami bomb in the mid-1940s, right around 1944 and 1945, I have, again, three separate media publications carried that same story that I just read. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not saying the Asian tsunami was an artificial thing. But what I am saying is it sure is, if it's not, it sure is working into the hands of the globalists. Because right now, at this time, there are sustainable communities being developed in the tsunami region. Sustainable communities are being developed. And I'm going to play you a report here in just a little bit from CBS News that was also aired Thursday of this week, yesterday evening, about the tsunami rebuilding process and how they're building these villages. And it's very interesting, but predictable, as Ordo Ab Chao, that's the name, that's the term that they use, and it means order out of chaos. Now, ladies and gentlemen, Bill Clinton has been put in charge of the tsunami relief effort. He's overseeing the money for the United Nations, and talk about the fox guarding the hen house. Mr. Whitewater himself is overseeing the money. But he was on the Letterman show last night, and now it's kind of interesting because keep in mind, as most of you know, I'm sure, that George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton are supposed to be big political rivals, right? We've told you folks in the past, and we've told you repeatedly, that there is no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. They keep this contest going back and forth for you to believe that there's a difference between parties, that there's actually some challenging going on, that there's, but it's all part of the Hegelian dialectic. It's to keep you in this train of thought that you're so confused that you don't really know what's going on. You don't realize that they work in tandem for the mutual destruction of the country. And that's what it boils down to. And now we're seeing them begin to show their true colors as they come together and unite to help fulfill the United Nations agenda. And part of that agenda is for United States and other developed countries to fund the rebuilding of developing countries, including the tsunami region. Now, Clinton was on the Letterman show last night, and this is what he said. Letterman asked him about his relationship with George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st president of the United States, because they've been having a lot of powwows and hanging around together lately. It's really kind of sickening. But this is what he had to say.
Well, I think we're good friends. You know, I like him. I like him very, very much. I've always liked him. And when he was vice president, I was still a governor. We worked together on a number of things, and he hosted the governors in 1983, 22 years ago, at his home in Kennebunkport. I'm going back there for the second time at the end of the month. Since I get back from Latin America, I'm going to go spend a day and a half with him. We're going to go out on his boat and go play golf. But I've always liked him. I liked him because the first time I met him in 83, I introduced my little three-year-old daughter, Chelsea. She hates me when I tell this story. And I said, "Chelsea, this is Vice President Bush, and this is his home." And she shook his hand and said, "Where's the bathroom?" and George Bush took her off to the bathroom, which is, you know, he's a very classy man and a good man.
Very endearing.
I like him very much. We've had a great time doing this tsunami work together. And we announced, we kept a little money we raised in a fund for ourselves. The Yankees are giving.
Well, hold on a second. Wait a minute.
For that fund.
Now, did you hear that, folks? I want to back that up here again. I want to play that one part again. Because it sounded to me like he just said that they kept some of the money. They kept some of the money for themselves?
And, we announced, we kept a little money we raised in a fund for ourselves. The Yankees are giving me some money.
Okay, tonight. Then he quickly moves on to something about the Yankees giving him some money, you know. Here's Bill Clinton. I don't know if that was a slip of the tongue or not, but he's announcing on national television that him and George Herbert Walker Bush have kept some of the relief money for themselves. This is incredible. So anyway, they turn a corner. They continue talking about the tsunami.
300,000 dead or missing, over 1 million homeless. Probably 5 million people had their livelihoods diminished by it. People cannot imagine the scope of it. And the giving was fabulous. Americans gave somewhere between $1.2 and $1.4 billion. The British gave $600 million. The Dutch gave hundreds of millions. Asians, who never given money to anything before. I'm talking ordinary people giving money to this. And now, you know, I'm working with the UN trying to coordinate all this so we don't overlap and so we make sure the money's spent well.
Yeah, so we can line our pockets.
All the decisions in the end have to be made by the governments in the host countries and the local communities. Then you have, in addition to them, you've got the donor governments like the United States. You've got the international institutions, the UN and all of its agencies. We're feeding 800,000 people a day still there. The UN has immunized over 1 million people. Then you've got the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, and literally hundreds and hundreds of non-governmental organizations. The biggest one's the Red Cross.
Okay, about the Red Cross, ladies and gentlemen, let me refresh your memory for those of you who might not remember. After September 11th, you know, the Red Cross, they raised something like, I think, $1.2 billion and purportedly this was supposed to go to the victims who were affected directly by the tragedy there, the so-called attack on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the aircraft that that crashed outside of Pittsburgh. Okay, all of this money was supposed to go to the victims. Now, the Toronto Star, William Walker, a reporter writing in the Toronto Star, at the time he wrote this, it wasn't $1.2 billion. I think it went on to be more than that afterwards. But he's got different figures, but it doesn't matter. The headline is, Storm Brews Over September 11th Funds. $200 million goes to other Red Cross programs. This was dated October 29, 2001, from the Toronto Star. He says, generous North Americans who gave more than $500 million to the Red Cross expected their donations would go directly to surviving family members and victims of the September 11th terrorist attacks. Canadians opened their wallets to donate $10 million to the New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania victims, Suzanne Charest of the Canadian Red Cross said last night. But in a growing scandal which threatens to rock the foundation's 120-year-old American Red Cross, it now appears that of the $530 million total donated, more than $200 million is being diverted to the Blood Agency's long-term goals and administrative costs. That includes, in U.S. dollars, $109 million for improving the Red Cross's telecommunications, accounting, and database management systems, $50 million for the agency's blood reserves program, $26 million for community outreach, whatever the heck that means, $29 million for indirect or administrative relief costs, $11 million for international assistance. How much of this actually made it to the victims? That's the real question here. But, of course, now the Red Cross is very heavily involved in tsunami relief. Gee, you think there might be something else in it for them, other than just helping people out?
And one of the things that we're trying to do is follow the slogan of Build Back Better. Now, we know how to build better homes, better health care clinics, better schools, but they have to define how they're going to diversify their economies. A lot of these people whose lives were ruined were just in simple fishing villages where they farmed little rice or a few other crops on the side. So we're trying to get them to diversify what they do for a living. The Indian government and the state of Tamil Nadu has done quite a good job of getting women who were fishermen or who became widowed to do various crafts work and sell them throughout India, and I'm hoping to help them market in the United States. But I think that's going to be the biggest challenge, getting the livelihood back. And then the most immediate thing for all the people involved is getting in decent housing. There's temporary housing. Some of them are tents, and they're hot. In India, some of them are 10-sided buildings, and they're hot. But it's a mammoth job. I mean, it just takes Sri Lanka. They got to build 100,000 houses, and I think last year there were 2,000 new homes built in the whole country. So it's a big job. But we do have lots of money now.
Yeah, we got lots of money now. This is an opportunity for them. You have to understand that. It's called capacity building. Capacity building. And somewhere around here I have the definitions to what capacity building. Yeah, here it is. Okay, looking up capacity building. And by the way, this connects to Chapter 7, of, or 37, rather, of Agenda 21. But capacity building is efforts aimed to develop human skills or societal infrastructures within a community or organization needed to reduce the level of risk. In extended understanding, capacity building also includes development of institutional, financial, political, and other resources such as technology at different levels and sectors of the society. The term used repeatedly in the Doha Declaration, referring to the assistance to be provided to developing countries in establishing and administering their trade policies, conducting analysis, and identifying their interests in trade negotiations. Again, we're talking about what capacity building means. Here's another definition. Creating the infrastructure necessary to support needed programs and services in communities. Helping a nonprofit housing program establish a volunteer network and creating a community watch program to reduce crime are examples of capacity building activities. Other examples include providing funding or helping an organization develop management systems. A commonly used term, capacity building, is for projects which improve the ability of communities or businesses and organizations to take the lead in their own development through improving their expertise and awareness about relevant issues. Capacity building is the process of building the potential for voluntary organizations to respond to the needs of the communities they serve. Activities that increase as individuals, populations, or communities' ability for growth, development, or accomplishment. That's capacity building. The ability of a country to follow sustainable development paths is determined to a large extent by the capacity of its people and its institutions, as well as by its ecological and geographical conditions. Specifically, capacity building encompasses the country's human, scientific, technological, organizational, institutional, and resource capabilities. Again, we reference chapters 37 of Agenda 21. Capacity building is the development of sustainable skills, organizational structures, resources, and commitment to health improvement in health and other sectors to prolong and multiply health gains many times over. Capacity building is about ensuring that organizations have the skills, knowledge, structures, and resources to realize their full potential. Activities, resources, and support that strengthen the skills and abilities of people and community groups to take effective action and leading roles in the development of their communities. Educational and organizational support, assistance to promote the ability of community housing development organizations and nonprofit organizations to maintain, rehabilitate, and construct housing for low and very low income persons and families. This activity may include, but is not limited to, organizational support to cover expenses for training. Does that sound like what's going on over in Asia right now? Organizational support to cover expenses for training, technical and other assistance to the board of directors, staff, and members of the nonprofit organization or community housing development organization. Program support, including technical assistance and training related to housing development, housing management, or other subjects related to the provision of housing or housing services and studies. Capacity building is a broad name for a wide range of support and techniques which aim to build the capacity of individuals or organizations within communities to contribute effectively to regeneration projects. Ladies and gentlemen, capacity building is what this Asian tsunami is all about. I have read to you now the documentation proving that it's possible that this Asian tsunami was a created crisis. Now, we've covered that information in the past, but I felt it was necessary to go over it again because we're dealing with it again. And we have to sometimes revisit things for the new listeners, so I trust that those of you who have been listening for a long time, you've heard the broadcasts that we've done in the past, that you'll be patient with us as we recover and revisit some things. But, folks, I got to tell you, as we go to the break here, and we're going to continue with more of the Clinton audio, but none of this capacity building that's going on in Asia right now would be possible if it hadn't been for the tsunami. So pardon me if I don't suggest, or at least be a little bit suspicious, that it wasn't just yet another created crisis. And we have more and more and more of these threats going on all the time, as these globalists always try to keep us in a perpetual state of fear. We got to take a break. More on the other side. I do hope you'll stay with us.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
If you'd like to get a copy of this program, there are a few ways that we can help you. You may subscribe at FirstAmendmentRadio.com for only $45 a month, and you'll receive an MP3 CD weekly of all of our programs. As a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online. That's a $15 value. Or you may request any month of any program on one MP3 CD for a minimum donation of only $25. Or any single program on tape, MP3 CD, or CD for only $15. You may do all of this online at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Just follow the instructions to make a donation or subscribe. You may also adopt an hour of your favorite program. Please don't forget that most of the programs on FirstAmendmentRadio.com are listener-supported. Don't do Internet? Then call 559-781-3773 and we'll be honored to help you. Thank you from all of us here at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Amazing Alan supermarket scene.
Guys?
Yes, Alan.
You want me to cut in front of these 15 people who are waiting in this very slow line?
That's right, Alan. And cut in front of the big guy with all the tattoos.
Why am I doing this?
To illustrate that people have a basic understanding of what is right and wrong, like knowing it is rude to cut in front of people.
But everybody knows that.
Right. And since there is a basic moral law, there must be a moral law giver.
Which means there's a God.
Right, a moral God. Okay, and action!
Okay, everybody, a new rule here. According to my standards, it's okay to get in line anywhere I want. Okay?
Hey, buddy, back of the line!
So, I'm going to get in the front of the line here.
Hey, I was here first!
Wait, pull me down, pull me
now
down!
What you did there was wrong!
Oh!
That's a take.
There's got to be a better way to make these points, guys!
A message from Lifeline Productions, 1-800-52-FUNNY, at lifelinepro.com.
Welcome back to American Exposé. I'm Darren Weeks as we continue on here. We're talking about the Hegelian dialectic today. We're talking about creating the crisis, creating the solution to the crisis, which brings about more control, which brings about the agenda of the controllers and what they wanted to accomplish in the first place. We're talking about capacity building today. Ladies and gentlemen, as capacity building is nation building, building the infrastructure, building the social development, the organizational structure to fulfill Agenda 21, the United Nations Blueprint for Sustainability across the world. Cashing in on the crisis and creating their own opportunities to fulfill their agenda is something that the globalists have been doing for a long time. George Herbert Walker Bush, September 11th, 1990. Isn't that interesting that it just happens to be the same date as September 11, 2001, that the terrorists supposedly attacked the World Trade Center? September 11, 1990, George Herbert Walker Bush said at the beginning of the first Gulf War, quote, "We stand today at a unique and extraordinary moment. The crisis in the Persian Gulf, as grave as it is, also offers a rare opportunity to move toward an historic period of cooperation. Out of these troubled times, our fifth objective, a new world order, can emerge." Tony Blair, after September 11, 2001, in a speech that they billed as the British media billed as one of the best speeches of his career, they said, quote, or he said, rather, quote, "This is a moment to seize." Talking about the tragic attack, supposed attack, upon all these people in New York and in the Pentagon and in that airliner that went down outside of Pittsburgh. He said, "This is a moment to seize. The kaleidoscope has been shaken. The pieces are in flux. Soon they will settle again. Before they do, let us reorder this world around us and use modern science to provide prosperity for all." What is he talking about, ladies and gentlemen, providing prosperity for all? He's talking about capacity building. He's talking about nation building. He's talking about infrastructure development. He's talking about sustainable development. He's talking about the redistribution of wealth, taking from the developed countries and giving that money, that largesse, to the developing countries. That's what he's talking about, because the guy's a socialist scum, just like the people that are running this country right now. George W. Bush, he's a socialist. His father is a socialist. Bill Clinton is a socialist. There's no difference between parties. Now, this past week, another very important story came out on WorldNet Daily, dated June 15, 2005. We've seen the British former member of Tony Blair's cabinet, his environmental minister, come out and talk about September 11th and how it was a hoax. The whole thing was a U.S. government operation, basically, is what he said. And that article is in 911.sweetliberty.org. Now we have a new one. As I noticed, this was published June 15th in the middle of the night, and just a couple hours later it was taken down off of WorldNet Daily. Now, why do you suppose that is? WorldNet Daily is a controlled publication. It's a neocon publication. They're pro-war. They're demonizing Iran. They're demonizing the Arab countries. They're very pro-Israel. Why does Israel have weapons of mass destruction? And we're going to get back to the Clinton stuff in just a moment. But I think this is important because all of this ties in together. All of it ties in together. But here we see Bush economist doubts 9/11 story. Ex-Labor Department hand says towers brought down by explosive. It says a former Bush team member during his first administration is now voicing serious doubts about the collapse of the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist for the Department of Labor during President George W. Bush's first term, says the official story about the collapse of the Twin Towers is, quote, bogus, unquote. And that it is more likely that a controlled demolition destroyed them and adjacent building number 7. Reynolds, who also served as director of the Criminal Justice Center at the National Center for Policy Analysis in Dallas, and is now professor emeritus at Texas A&M University, told UPI, quote, if demolition destroyed 3 steel skyscrapers at the World Trade Center on 9/11, then the case for an inside job and a government attack on America would be compelling, unquote. Reynolds added, quote, it is hard to exaggerate the importance of a scientific debate over the cause of the collapse of the Twin Towers and Building 7. If the official wisdom on the collapses is wrong, as I believe it is, he said, then policy based on such erroneous engineering analysis is not likely to be correct either. The government's collapse theory is highly vulnerable on its own terms. Only professional demolition appears to account for the full range of facts associated with the collapse of the 3 buildings. Unquote. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a former Bush cabinet member talking about the official story of 9/11 and calling it bogus. Now, why aren't you seeing this reported in the news? And, of course, that's a rhetorical question. You all know the answer to that. But if we don't have a... well, I guess he's just a conspiracy theorist. He's just one of those conspiracy kooks. Right, Mr. Art Bell? Right, Mr. Chertoff? Just another conspiracy wing nut, right? And then Dennis sent me this information. Very interesting. The Pentagon, he says, conducted a drill in December of 2000 to respond to an airline crashing into the Pentagon. They actually, a year before September 11th, were were rehearsing with models of the Pentagon and airplane models. This comes from a military website, www.mdw.army.mil/news/contingency planning, and between those words there's an underscore, and contingency and planning are capitalized in .html. It says contingency planning Pentagon Mascal exercise simulates scenarios in preparing for emergencies. This is Dateline, Washington, D.C., November 3rd, 2000. The fire and smoke from a downed passenger aircraft billows from the Pentagon courtyard. Defense Protective Services, police seal the crash site. Army medics, nurses, and doctors scramble to organize aid. An Arlington Fire Department chief dispatches his equipment to the affected areas. Don Abbott of Command Engineering or Command Emergency Response Training walks over to the Pentagon and extinguishes the flames. The Pentagon was a model, and the plane crash was a simulated one. The Pentagon mass casualty exercise, as the crash was called, was just one of several scenarios that emergency response teams were exposed to October 24th to 26th in the office of the Secretaries of Defense conference room. On October 24th, there was a mock terrorist incident at the Pentagon Metro stop and the construction accident, to name just some of the scenarios that were practiced to better prepare local agencies for real incidents. What a coincidence that we have them rehearsing an attack on the Pentagon with airplanes just a year before the actual event. What a magnificent coincidence that just a month prior to this rehearsal, actually 2 months prior to this rehearsal, in a full year, the Project for a New American Century report was published, which mapped out the war on terror. Ladies and gentlemen, there's too much smoke to not be a fire. And there's so many things about it. Then we have the Downing memo. The Downing Street memo, which recently came to light. Now, this is actually a document containing meeting minutes transcribed during the British Prime Minister's meeting on July 23, 2002, a full 8 months prior to the invasion of Iraq on March 20, 2003. The Times of London printed the text of this document on Sunday, May 1, 2005, but to date, U.S. media coverage has been limited. The contents of the memo are shocking. The minutes detail how our government did not believe Iraq was a greater threat than other nations, how intelligence was fixed to sell the case for war to the American public, and how the Bush administration's public assurances of war as a last resort were at odds with their privately stated intentions. When asked, British officials did not dispute the document's authenticity, and that was according to CNN. And a senior American official has described it as absolutely accurate. And that's a direct quote from Newsday. Yet the Bush administration continues to simultaneously sidestep the issue whilst attempting to cast doubt on the memo's authenticity. This Downing Street memo, and you can get more information about this, and this is what I read to you just a moment ago, is from DowningStreetMemo.com. But they have links to actual documentation, including the actual report, the actual memo, which as it was reproduced and published in the British media, the Times of London. Now, last night, on Late Night with David Letterman, or the David Letterman Show, whatever it's called now, Bill Clinton was asked about this, and this was his response.
Do you know something about, it's called the Downing Street memo? Are you familiar with that?
What was that?
It's my understanding of it is that it's something that's been published in Great Britain, document leaked to the Times of London, indicating that there was strategy in place to take Saddam Hussein out, and the U.S. would then line up the intelligence to support that.
Okay, now, ladies and gentlemen, listen to his response, because here is a rare admission. See, this is what we call telling the truth slowly, okay? Originally, Saddam was a bad guy. Saddam had to be taken out. Saddam's a threat to everyone. He supports Al Qaeda. He supports terrorists. He had a hand in the September 11th terrorist attacks. None of that was true. And now we know it was true. Now that we've went into Iraq, we've destroyed that country. We've destroyed those people's lives. We killed untold numbers of people over there. We have 1,700 of our own soldiers that we know about that are dead. And, you know, I read somewhere, and I forget where it was, but they don't count the ones that are on the threshold of dying that they airlift out of there. Only if they die in Iraq are they actually counted as Iraq casualties, according to that source that I've read. So the number is undoubtedly, or more than likely, being held artificially low. But 1,700 that we actually know about, and that doesn't even count the ones that are coming back with depleted uranium poisoning and other things. But we've absolutely devastated this country of Iraq, upset these people's lives, created untold suffering and turmoil for these people. And all on false pretenses because, well, the New World Order had to go forward and Iraq had to be conquered. But at any rate, here is the admission of former President Bill Clinton.
And I've heard something about it. I haven't read it. I can't comment on it. But I think it's clear that the president and a lot of people in the administration wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein before they took office.
Did you hear that, folks? He just said it's clear. It's clear that a lot of people in the administration wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein before they took office. Now, we've been telling you that all along, but here's the former president of the United States admitting this on national television. And you could chalk this up to partisan politics, but hey, they're buddies now. They're good friends.
And we know that Vice President Cheney made repeated trips to the CIA headquarters and sat with the analysts. And I don't think that they thought he came there just to have a cup of coffee with them and ask them how they were feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that. But, you know, whatever you think about that, we are where we are, and that 1,700 good Americans have given their lives there. Hillary's on the Armed Services Committee, you know, so she's been twice and been out to Walter Reed to see the wounded. And
as if that really matters to anything.
And we have children of our friends who've served there, and thankfully they've all survived so far.
Yeah, why is that? What capacity were they serving in? I guarantee it wasn't combat operations.
But whatever you think about it, before, we are where we are, and we ought to want it to work, because if it does work, then the 58% of the Iraqis who showed up to vote will be validated. That's a higher percent turnout than we had.
Yeah, and what makes you think they're going to have honest elections over there when we can't have honest elections here? You know, the end justifies the mean, doesn't it, Mr.
It's
Clinton?
A tough slog, and it is frustrating because the thing was sold to the Congress in the beginning and to the American people as a search for weapons of mass destruction, and then we didn't let the UN finish the search, which I think was an error. Nonetheless, Saddam was a bad guy, the Iraqis voted, and a lot of them are trying, and they're dying in much bigger numbers than we are. That's something the American people should remember.
Yeah, so everyone should take comfort that, hey, more Iraqis are dying defending their country from the bad guys than the Americans are. What a load of garbage that is. Now, this whole notion of weapons of mass destruction and Saddam Hussein being a bad guy made me think that I had Dan Rather's last interview with Saddam Hussein on tape, okay? This is kind of interesting to go back and listen to, folks, because, again, I'm not saying Saddam Hussein's an angel, okay? I don't want to get in his corner, and I'm not saying that at all. But I want you to understand that this guy was telling the truth, okay? We're led to believe that he's such an evil character all the time, and that there's nothing good about him. This guy is like the equivalent of the Antichrist, right? And when Dan Rather was interviewing him, and of course you got to listen to him through an interpreter, but this was broadcast on 60 Minutes. It was broadcast on the controlled media. And yet, he was telling the truth. Listen to this.
Do you intend to destroy the Asamud missiles that the United Nations prohibits? Will you destroy those missiles?
We have committed ourselves to Resolution 1441. It is on this basis that we have conducted ourselves, and it is on this basis that we will continue to behave. As you know, we are allowed to produce land-to-land rockets with a range of up to 150 kilometers, and we are committed to that.
Okay, so he said, this is what the UN says we can have, and this is what we do have. Okay, so what does Dan Rather do? He goes on to assume that Saddam just said a simple no.
I want to make sure that I understand, Mr. President. So you do not intend to destroy these missiles?
Which missiles are you talking about? We do not have missiles that go beyond the prescribed ranges by the UN.
I mean the missiles that Hans Blix says that he wants a commitment from you that they will be destroyed.
No violation has been made by Iraq to anything decided by the United Nations. If the intention is to rewrite those resolutions, then we will be entering a new framework, a framework in which the United States will be made to forsake its own position and take a new road towards harming Iraq.
Now, isn't that interesting? He said all along, we don't have any weapons of mass destruction. We don't have the missiles that the United Nations... you say that the United Nations is saying that that we're not allowed to have. We don't have those things. We don't have anything that's prohibited. Now, first of all, folks, Iraq is a sovereign country, or was before we went in and took care of that. Anything that we have, they should be allowed to have, because they're a sovereign country. Who made the United States, or the UN, depending upon which way you want to go with this, the policemen of the world? Who died and left us in charge of policing the world? That's the question. And a sovereign country should not have to recognize any global authority whatsoever. So anything that we have, anything Israel has, anything any country has, the Iraqis should be able to have as well. See, and the point is that what better way to discourage attacks when you're armed to the hilt? Because somebody's going to get wiped out if they use it. And that's the point. It discourages use. When other people, and you know, I mean, they always paint these people as nuts and crazy. I got a feeling they're not as crazy as they say they are. But at any rate, he's saying we don't have them. And now we know that he was telling the truth.
In our interview, Saddam Hussein gave no indication he will capitulate to an ultimatum from Chief Weapons Inspector Blix to begin destroying the missiles by this weekend. Indeed, he hinted he will not. Saddam also rejected Bush administration allegations that besides the missile delivery system, he still has weapons of mass destruction.
I think America and the world also knows that Iraq no longer has the weapons. And I believe the mobilization that's been done was in fact done partly to cover the huge lie that was being waged against Iraq about chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. That is why, when you talk about such missiles, these missiles have been destroyed. There are no missiles that are contrary to the prescription of the United Nations in Iraq. They are no longer there.
There you go. He said they've been destroyed. Why didn't we find them if he actually had them? The point is, folks, the whole Iraq war was nothing but another created crisis for the purpose of fulfilling the United Nations agenda, because apparently Saddam Hussein wasn't going along with the program. It was about taking control. Oil, yes. Oil was a part of it, but a small part of it. It's about controlling the people. It's about controlling the earth. It's about controlling the resources. They want it all. And they're not going to let a sovereign country like Iraq stand. And they're not going to let Iran stand. They're not going to let North Korea stand. These people are greedy, as extreme as you can define the word. And that's the bottom line. Okay, I have one more clip here about Bill Clinton. Here he's talking about all the things that we're doing. We're going to do this over in Iraq. This is the goal that we have. And he's talking almost like he's the president. None of this is stuff that we should be doing. As a sovereign country, we have no business having any goals, any ambitions over there. And yet, they're working as a team, these Republicans and Democrats.
I think the insurgents are playing on the fact in the areas where they can operate that they try to intimidate the Sunnis who had run the country for a long time into not voting. A number of them did vote, but not in as high numbers as the Shias in the south and the Kurds in the north. And so they think they're underrepresented now, and the government's trying to work all that out. So they may be trying to take advantage of that to build popular opposition. But in this sort of insurgency, the only thing that can stop it in the end is the capability of the Iraqis to defend themselves. And so our number one priority there has to be to train them and to organize their forces so that they can be increasingly effective. And we've had mixed results, but on the whole, there's been a lot of progress there, and a lot of fine Americans have done everything they could to make it work, and so I'm hoping it will. There's still a chance that this thing will work, and I don't think the American people should give up on it. And I don't think the president is wrong not to set a date certain for withdrawal, because if you set a date certain for withdrawal, it's like waving a red flag to all the adversaries, all the opponents of the regime, all the opponents of democracy. Hold out, don't make a deal, don't compromise, just wait for the Americans to leave.
Here you have a former Democratic president and a former Republican president working together to fulfill a single global agenda. Now, you can talk all you want to about partisan politics and arguing back and forth, but somebody tell me how there's any difference between these two. There's not. And anybody says there is, they're lying to you. We have to go. We're out of time. Thanks for being with us. I'm sorry I didn't get to that CBS News piece about the tsunami rebuilding, because that certainly describes sustainable communities going in. We'll have to play that another time. We're out of time, folks. Thanks for being with us. Join me again on Monday. We'll have another broadcast, and have a good weekend. Good night, folks.
When you turn and find that you're all alone, and the velvet wall at night moves in, wraps around you like a wall of stone. Just when your final prayer has flown, love will get there. When a mother's touch is far away, you close your eyes and you hear a voice whispering, it'll be okay. Just hold on for one more day.